Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you very much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop. And the focus of today's program is an update from the 2011 American Society of Hematology, ASH, annual meeting. And that is a very important meeting, and it's a wonderful opportunity for us to actually share with you some of the findings of that meeting. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and it really is because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. Now, we have on the call today over 676 participants on the call, and you come from all over the United States, from all different parts of this country, and we also have international participants from Canada, Sudan, and the United Kingdom, so it's a global call. Now, today's program was made possible by an educational grant from Friends of Cancer Care, and I want to thank them for their support. I would like to turn your attention for a moment to the materials that you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there is an outline that our speakers have prepared, and there also is information about all of the different collaborating organizations as resources for all of you. And there also is an evaluation form, a feedback form, really, for us, and I would ask you all to take a moment at the end of our program today and complete that feedback evaluation form. When you think about it, who but each of you can best tell us the topics and the subjects you'd like us to offer going forward? Indeed, we're starting this as a new year, and we're planning many programs. And indeed, today's program was really based on your recommendations and really requests that we offer this program. So we take your recommendations very seriously. You're our best, really, consultants on what we should be offering because you're living the experience. So let us know what you want, and we'll try very hard to offer it. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Neil Shah. And Dr. Shah is Associate Professor, Division of Hematology Oncology, co-leader, Hematopoietic Malignancies Program, Helen Dilla Family Comprehensive Cancer Center, Edward A. Agino, Distinguished Professor, University of California at San Francisco. Dr. Shah wears many hats, and he is going to present to us today an overview of blood cancers, a new research presented at ASH on leukemia, disease-specific treatment updates, and talking with your healthcare team about your treatment options. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Shah.
Thank you very much, and thanks to everybody for listening in today. As you just heard, blood-related cancers is, of course, the topic of today's call, and we generally divide blood-related cancers into leukemias, lymphomas, and myelomas, and you're going to hear, you know, more about these today. But one thing I want to stress about blood-related cancers is that even within leukemias, as you'll hear during my presentation, there are different subtypes of leukemia, and even within those different subtypes, there are numerous further subdivisions. We're learning as we study these diseases just how different they can be from individual to individual. And so one of the emerging themes that we're all becoming aware of is the importance of trying to understand for a given individual moving towards a situation where we can perhaps understand an individual's blood-related cancer at the molecular level and ideally eventually enable us to choose treatments that are specifically designed for that particular individual's blood-related cancer. And to give you an idea of how this is evolving, it is through both a dramatic explosion in our understanding of the molecular basis of these diseases, largely through what we call gene sequencing or tumor DNA sequencing of these different tumors to identify mutations, which of course are genetic changes that drive these cancers. And that coupled with our ability to more rapidly develop compounds that actually selectively inhibit particular proteins that are inappropriately expressed or inappropriately activated enables us to develop really smart treatments so that the old-fashioned chemotherapy drugs that we all know about from the popular press and from movies where people would lose their hair and get very sick, those types of things are hopefully are not so commonly being developed as we develop more and more of these smart treatments. And at the heart of all this, our success depends upon the participation of people with blood-related cancers in clinical trials. And so most of what I'm going to be talking about and most of what we hear about at the American Society of Hematology meeting is actually relates to clinical trials, and that's where we get a hint of the promise of things to come. And so I certainly would urge all of you to look into potential clinical trial options for your particular blood-related cancers. That's the only way that we can move progress forward. So moving on to talk about leukemias, this is a specific type of blood-related cancer, which is primarily manifested in the bone marrow or in the blood, where we see abnormal white blood cells. Now, leukemias are subdivided into four broad categories, and these are either chronic myeloid leukemia, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, acute myeloid leukemia, or acute lymphoblastic leukemia. These are the four broad categorizations, but as I mentioned, even within these, there are several instances where, for instance, acute lymphoblastic leukemia is comprised of a number of different subsets of disease. And you'll hear an example of how we're learning more about that in just a moment. But first I want to start with chronic myeloid leukemia, because that's really a disease where our understanding of the molecular basis has really driven the progress in developing, actually at this point, three well-tolerated treatments that are dramatically improving the outlook for patients who are diagnosed with chronic myeloid leukemia. The first of these was a drug you may have heard of called imatinib or Gleevec, which was really an eye-opener from the perspective that it was the first sort of rationally designed smart drug that was designed to go after the molecular abnormality in the leukemia cells of patients with chronic myeloid leukemia. Basically, this drug, which was approved back in 2001, achieved a very high rate of remission, but we learned that some patients would relapse, most commonly because the intended target of the drug could develop subtle mutations that prevented the drug from binding. And this led to the investigation of new treatments to override that mechanism of disease resistance. And two subsequent drugs, dasatinib and nilotinib, have been approved. And in fact, both of these drugs actually are appearing to be superior to imatinib in newly diagnosed patients. But one common weakness of this approach has been that there's been one drug-resistant mutation that's been resistant to all three of these drugs. And when a patient would develop this particular mutation, their disease would not respond to anything that we could offer. But encouragingly, what we heard about the ASH meeting is a clinical study with a new inhibitor that was initially designed specifically to target this particular drug-resistant mutation. And in the initial study, 9 out of 12 patients who had that drug-resistant mutation had a very deep response, and the response seems to be maintained. And at this ASH meeting, a larger analysis was reported with more than 300 patients whose disease was essentially resistant or they had difficulty tolerating all three of the approved agents. And what this study found was, again, a remarkably high rate of deep response relatively early on. I'm not going to go into the specific numbers, but we certainly expect this drug, which is called ponatinib, to be approved within a year's time, and that will be great because it will offer us yet a fourth targeted treatment for this disease and will presumably take what is already an excellent outcome, expected outcome for most people who are diagnosed with this disease, and make it even better. So that's some of the best news regarding the disease CML that was presented. The other bit of news that was presented regarding CML is that there's another inhibitor, which is unfortunately not active against that one drug-resistant mutation, but is also but is active against many of the other drug-resistant mutations, that is likely to be approved as well within the coming year, we hope, and that's called bosutinib. It achieved a higher rates of deep response, deep molecular responses, when compared with imatinib in patients who previously had not been treated with any therapy. So this agent is likely to be approved as well. We're also learning that it's possible to predict who is likely to do well versus who may need a change in their treatment strategy as early as 3 months after they start treatment, by simply quantifying the amount of the molecular abnormality called BCR-ABL that drives this disease in the blood 3 months after starting treatment. So in essence, patients who have a deep response after 3 months of at least of a level down to 10% from the starting level of this abnormal gene have a better outcome than patients who have lesser degrees of response. And so this is giving us an opportunity to intervene early and identify people who may be less likely to do well, whereas we can continue our treatment in those people who meet this treatment milestone. Now, acute myeloid leukemia has been a disease that is something that we have been treating largely with chemotherapy in the past. And given the dramatic improvements with outcomes that's been observed with targeting the molecular abnormality of CML, there's been a lot of effort to try to understand what other molecular abnormalities there are in these other diseases and if we can target them. So in acute myeloid leukemia, about a third of patients have mutations in a gene called FLT3 or FLT3. And what was encouraging is that an inhibitor of FLT3 has been developed that's very potent, that is achieving about a 45% complete remission rate in the bone marrow of patients who have taken this agent. And these are patients whose disease is already resistant to chemotherapy. And patients taking this drug have had deep responses, and moreover, we've learned that patients can relapse on this drug, but we've learned that the cause of relapse are drug-resistant mutations in FLT3, and there are some newer agents coming down the pipeline that may have promise for patients whose disease loses response to this particular initial FLT3 inhibitor. And so we're trying to extrapolate what we've learned in CML and bring it towards acute myeloid leukemia. One of the more interesting clinical abstracts presented on acute myeloid leukemia had to do with actually resurrecting a drug that had kind of fallen off the radar because it was actually eliminated from the shelves because it was not the most effective drug. And this drug was called gemtuzumab ozogamicin, also known as Mylotarg. And in a French study, patients between the ages of 50 and 70 were randomized to either receive chemotherapy or chemotherapy plus 3 doses of this antibody that's called gemtuzumab ozogamicin. And the differences in outcome was actually dramatic. Patients who received the chemotherapy along with the gemtuzumab ozogamicin did substantially better than patients who just received the chemotherapy. So it's a beautiful example of how clinical trials can hopefully, in some cases, even resurrect therapies that we thought were not active, and then somebody designs a study that actually makes us think once again about using, or the proper way, if you will, or a better way to use some of these therapies. Now, acute lymphoblastic leukemia is a third type of leukemia that is predominantly a childhood leukemia, and most of these cases, at least when they occur in children, can respond very well to chemotherapy approaches, and this disease has become largely curable in children as a result of a large number of clinical trials that have been done over the years. But some of the interesting abstracts for this has to do for this disease at the meeting had to do with new information about molecular causes of some of the cases that don't do so well with chemotherapy. And one group actually used sophisticated molecular techniques to identify a subset of patients who had recurrent mutations in a number of different genes, but all of which are in what we call a signaling family of genes. Some of these may be amenable or may be responsive to treatments that we already have. So you can begin to see how important it is to almost get to where we personalize treatment based upon the individual mutations that a given person's leukemia may have. And then the last, in the interest of time, the last type of leukemia I'll talk about briefly is chronic lymphocytic leukemia. This is one of the more common adult leukemias, more common in older individuals. It has been something that has been manageable, but we haven't had treatments so far that can make the disease go away and stay away forever. But there have been many treatments that have been developed to which the disease can respond, and there are some new targeted treatments, including one agent, which is an inhibitor of a protein called BTK, and what was quite encouraging in this particular study is that in patients whose disease was already resistant to at least two prior treatments, out of 61 of these patients, the overall response rate to this new molecule, which again is something that targets a specific protein that's probably important for the viability of this leukemia, that the overall response rate was 70%, which is really eye-opening in patients whose disease has already relapsed following two prior therapies. And so the way that we find out what's going to work, again, comes back to participation in clinical trials. I at this point, we'll turn it back over to Carolyn Messner, who will introduce the next topic.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Shah, for just a really outstanding presentation and for covering really a lot of broad topics and giving a lot of information to the participants on the call. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Dr. Kenneth Anderson, and Dr. Anderson is a Kraft Family Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Director, LeBeau Institute for Myeloma Therapeutics, Director, Jerome Lipper Multiple Myeloma Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, and American Cancer Society Clinical Research Professor. As you can see, actually, I'm going to say this about all of our speakers, they all wear many hats and have many different important roles in understanding cancer and blood cancers. And Dr. Anderson is going to address a new research presented at ASH on multiple myeloma, disease-specific treatment updates, and the role of clinical trials. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Anderson.
Thank you very much, Carolyn. It is indeed a pleasure for me to update you on the progress in multiple myeloma. To put that into context, you're all well aware that over the last decade, we've had new classes of drugs that have been developed in multiple myeloma. The first one is the immunomodulatory drugs, which includes thalidomide, lenalidomide, and the new one now, pomalidomide, that I'll mention in a minute. And then we've also been blessed to have the proteasome inhibitors go from the bench to the bedside. And the one you know there well best is bortezomib, but I will be mentioning new members of that drug class as well. In addition, there's entirely new classes of medicines that are looking very promising. Just by way of background or setting in which to frame this progress, we know that if you combine lenalidomide, one of the immunomodulatory drugs, with bortezomib, the proteasome inhibitor, and dexamethasone, pretty much universal responses occur, and roughly the majority of patients get a very good partial response, and up to half of the patients get a complete response. So it really is a testament to the power of these new agents to have a remarkable extent and frequency of response, unprecedented in its nature. So that's what's happened up until now. Then ASH met in San Diego in December, and we had further progress. Firstly, in the upfront management, or the treatment, if you will, of newly diagnosed multiple myeloma patients, Dr. Jesus San Miguel from Spain updated the use of melphalan, prednisone, and bortezomib in newly diagnosed elderly patients with myeloma. It's the so-called VISTA trial, but it is the trial that compared bortezomib, melphalan, prednisone versus melphalan, prednisone in elderly newly diagnosed patients, and is the trial upon which the approval of bortezomib for use to treat newly diagnosed myeloma was based. The exciting news at ASH last year was, now with 5 years follow-up, there is a major overall survival advantage for the use of bortezomib. So very exciting, persistent advantage if you receive bortezomib as part of your initial treatment. Moreover, if you looked within that trial, it didn't matter age or kidney dysfunction or cytogenetic abnormalities. It was always better to receive the three drugs, bortezomib, melphalan, prednisone, than melphalan and prednisone. And it was better to receive the three drugs rather than getting melphalan, prednisone, and saving the bortezomib for later. So really long follow-up, solid data for and evidence for using new drugs initially. Two studies then said, well, I wonder if we can improve that by using bortezomib as a maintenance strategy. And one of these was from Dr. Mateos in Spain, and the other one was from Dr. Ruben Nizinski in New York, home of the world champion New York Giants, unfortunately. In any event, both of those studies showed that maintenance bortezomib given at different schedules, but usually at lesser doses and less frequently, can prolong the time without active myeloma, which we call progression-free survival. So very strong data for using bortezomib early and using it as maintenance in the elderly, newly diagnosed patient. In a similar vein, Dr. Palumbo from Italy combined melphalan and prednisone with lenalidomide and also used lenalidomide as a maintenance. And what he showed overall is, in the elderly patients, the time without myeloma was markedly improved when you used lenalidomide as part of the initial treatment and as maintenance. What he did at ASH was focus on the individuals who were 65 to 75 years of age, and there it was a really very impressive difference, markedly in favor of using lenalidomide initially and lenalidomide as maintenance therapy. So very exciting for using new drugs up front and also using them in a maintenance way. Other studies that I would mention to you would be in the patients who are now transplant candidates, those who are younger and who have the kidney, liver, lung, and heart function that allows them to be candidates for high-dose treatment and stem cell transplant. And there what we saw were two advances, I think. There were updates presented on the CALGB trial from the United States and the IFM trial from France, both of which showed that if you use lenalidomide as a maintenance after high-dose therapy and transplantation, in so doing, you can double the time during which myeloma is inactive. We call it progression-free survival. And in the CALGB United States trial, you actually live longer by virtue of taking lenalidomide maintenance. So just as we saw in the elderly population, so it appears to be true in the transplant population. Lenalidomide maintenance is very useful. There were also trials reported, one by Dr. Palumbo, which examined the actual role of transplantation in the context of these new medicines. In particular, patients who were eligible for transplant received lenalidomide and dexamethasone, and then they were randomly assigned to receive lenalidomide melphalan prednisone tablets followed by lenalidomide maintenance, or two high-dose therapies with melphalan and autologous stem cell transplantation, and again, followed by lenalidomide maintenance. And the response rates were not different in those who were randomized to the oral regimen versus the two transplants. The time without myeloma appears to be in favor of receiving the transplant, but the overall survival is not different yet. The point I'm making, though, is just that with all this exciting data with new medicines, it's now possible for us together to look at the relative value of transplantation or how we can make transplantation better by using new medicines before and after it. And then I'd like to move now quickly to the treatment of relapsed myeloma, because in spite of the exciting progress I just described, myeloma usually does unfortunately return. And I mentioned this at the outset, but we now have second-generation proteasome inhibitors. Bortezomib was the first, but several are now coming. One of them is called carfilzomib. It's an intravenous, stronger proteasome inhibitor that has a more prolonged inhibition, and a depth of inhibition is greater. At ASH was reported exciting studies showing it to be remarkably active in relapsed myeloma and extending its activity even to patients whose myeloma does no longer respond to bortezomib. Exciting here is its side effect profile. There's very little in the way of neuropathy, for example. And exciting also is that it has been combined, carfilzomib that is, with lenalidomide and dexamethasone, just as I mentioned earlier, with bortezomib, lenalidomide, and dexamethasone. And Dr. Jakubowiak reported that those three medicines, carfilzomib, the new proteasome inhibitor, lenalidomide, and dex, when used initially, again, gets very high extent and frequency of response. Another proteasome inhibitor is called murizumib. It's a more broad-acting proteasome inhibitor than is carfilzomib or bortezomib. It is early in its studies. However, in studies in the United States and Australia, there was early hints of remarkable activity, even in bortezomib-resistant myeloma. So that's another one to keep in mind, murizumib. But the third one I want to highlight is called MLN9708, and I think it represents futuristic trends in myeloma treatment. It's an oral proteasome inhibitor. It was very active in advanced myeloma in studies reported at ASH, and it's even been combined in a similar vein with lenalidomide and dexamethasone for an all-oral regimen as initial treatment, and it's very active. So second-generation proteasome inhibitors are here to stay. In a similar vein, there's a new immunomodulatory drug coming in the footsteps of thalidomide and lenalidomide is the drug called pomalidomide. And at the American Society of Hematology, there were three different studies, one multicenter trial from the United States presented by Paul Richardson, one trial from France, and one trial from the Mayo Clinic, or a series of trials from the Mayo Clinic. And the summary is that the oral pomalidomide is remarkably active with response rates perhaps in a third or more of the patients whose myeloma does no longer respond to either bortezomib or lenalidomide. These responses are durable, and it is well tolerated. So very exciting. And then finally, just to sort of whet your appetite and mention a few new drugs, there is a monoclonal antibody called elotuzumab that is looking very promising, not by itself, but together with lenalidomide and dexamethasone in achieving very high rates of response in myeloma that has relapsed. There are also other combinations with bortezomib, such as the histone deacetylase inhibitors, either vorinostat or panobinostat. And the simple concept there is when you add a histone deacetylase inhibitor, either vorinostat or pantobinostat, to bortezomib, you're blocking with the former one pathway to degrade proteins, and with the latter, the other pathway to block protein degrade proteins. So the myeloma cell basically fills up with its own protein and commits suicide. And so the HDAC inhibitor or histone deacetylase inhibitor plus proteasome inhibitor combination is also looking very active. And then finally, I just want to finish by mentioning that the only way that all of this progress has been made and will continue is the discovery has to continue in the laboratory and in the animal models, but then all of us on the phone need to work together and continue to carry out clinical trials. And I just want to, on behalf of everyone on the phone, thank those of you who are patients and caregivers, because with active participation in clinical trials, we together will continue this very amazing progress. So I think I'll turn it over to Carolyn again at this point, please.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Anderson, for, of course, a wonderful presentation, excellent, and also for actually commenting and really speaking quite strongly about the important role of clinical trials and how much we do thank everyone on the call for participating in trials and how that does advance what we know about all cancers. So thank you very much. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Our next speaker is Dr. Oliver Press. And Dr. Press is member of Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, recipient Dr. Penny E. Peterson Memorial Chair for Lymphoma Research, and he's professor of medicine, University of Washington, and co-chair NCI Lymphoma Steering Committee. Dr. Press also wears many hats, and he is going to address new research presented at ASH on lymphoma, disease-specific treatment updates, and quality of life concerns. And it's my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Press.
Thank you. My topic is to speak about lymphomas. Lymphomas are cancers of cells of the immune system that are called lymphocytes. And there are two different types of lymphocytes. There are lymphocytes that are produced in the bone marrow, and those are called B lymphocytes, and lymphocytes that are produced in the thymus gland, and those are called T lymphocytes. So if a malignant change occurs in a B lymphocyte, you have a B cell lymphoma, and if it occurs in a thymus-derived lymphocyte, there is a T cell lymphoma. All of the lymphomas typically present with enlarged lymph nodes, but can also have enlarged spleen, bone marrow involvement, or really involvement in any organ of the body, since lymphocytes are migratory. There are about 79,000 new cases of lymphoma that develop in the United States every year, and there are about 500,000 Americans living with a history of lymphoma. Talking about lymphoma is a very complicated field because there are 70 different subtypes of lymphoma. But for the purpose of today's talk, I'm going to simplify things a little and just talk about three groups. First of all, Hodgkin lymphomas. Secondly, non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, and they come in two flavors, either aggressive, rapidly growing non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, or alternatively, indolent, slow-growing non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. I think I'll begin first by talking about aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphomas. The prototype of the aggressive non-Hodgkin's lymphoma is a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. It is a very highly curable subtype, and the standard of care in the world now is a regimen called R-CHOP, which involves the use of a monoclonal antibody called rituximab, and then four chemotherapy drugs. And this regimen is usually given every 21 days for usually about six cycles. If a patient isn't cured with R-CHOP, and the majority are, but if a patient isn't, then usually a backup regimen is used. Rice is another four-drug regimen that's often employed, and that's followed by doing high-dose chemotherapy and a stem cell transplant. And there again, there's a second opportunity for cure in the disease. So that's the standard of care, but at the national meeting at ASH, we heard about several new drugs which might work in cases where the standard of care unfortunately doesn't, or might someday substitute for the standard of care. And many of these new treatments are exciting because they target specific pathways that are deranged or abnormal in the lymphoma cell and won't affect the normal cells so much. One such agent is a bispecific antibody called blinatumomab. This is an antibody that binds, one arm of it binds to a lymphoma cell and the other arm binds to a T lymphocyte. It brings them together and allows the body's immune system to kill the lymphoma cell. And in a study of patients who had failed conventional therapy, 20 of 28 people had excellent responses with this new bispecific antibody. Another extremely exciting drug is called a Bruton tyrosine kinase inhibitor. I know that's a lot of words to hold together, but it targets a pathway that's abnormal in many of the B-cell lymphomas. And this agent has had very exciting results, not just in aggressive lymphomas, but also in indolent lymphomas, and I think is one of the most exciting drugs for the future. There were several other treatments that were very interesting. For T-cell lymphomas, there are three new drugs that have recently been approved that showed excellent results in studies presented at ASH. One is a monoclonal antibody directed against a molecule called CD30 attached to a chemotherapy drug called auristatin E. The generic name of the drug is brentuximab vedotin. And it has shown amazing responses in both anaplastic large T-cell lymphomas and also, interestingly, in Hodgkin's lymphoma. And then there are two more conventional drugs, pralatrexate and romidepsin, which have been recently approved, which also show excellent responses in T-cell lymphomas. I'm going to turn now to the second of the three categories of lymphomas, namely indolent or slow-growing or low-grade lymphomas. These lymphomas tend to be chronic diseases that respond to treatment, go away for many years, and then tend to reoccur, get treated again. And patients may be treated sometimes on treatment and off treatment for several decades. There are many acceptable treatments. In some cases, no treatment at all is necessary, and so watchful waiting alone is acceptable. In other cases, we'll use the rituximab antibody by itself. And then there are combination treatments, RCVP, R-CHOP, or most recently, the most popular treatment is rituximab along with a new drug called bendamustine. There were some very exciting new drugs that were presented at ASH for indolent lymphomas. There is a molecule called CAL-101 that targets a specific pathway found in many lymphomas, particularly the indolent slow-growing lymphomas like follicular lymphoma, CLL, small lymphocytic lymphoma, mantle cell lymphoma, and really very, very exciting results were seen in all those subtypes using CAL-101. There are also some new monoclonal antibodies, one called obinutuzumab, which looks at least as good, if not a little better, than rituximab. And then there are exciting results using lenalidomide along with rituximab. So lenalidomide that Dr. Anderson talked about for myeloma is also a very effective drug for lymphomas, particularly indolent lymphomas. Finally, I'm going to turn to the third category of lymphoma, Hodgkin's lymphoma. The standard of care has generally been a chemotherapy regimen called ABVD, either alone or combined with radiation treatment. Those treatments have been around for a while and cure the vast majority of patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma. If they're not cured with those frontline treatments, we often do a stem cell transplant. I think the new developments in Hodgkin lymphoma have really been around producing less toxic treatments. A lot of times we cure patients with Hodgkin's lymphoma, but 20 or 30 years later they may come down with a secondary cancer due to our chemotherapy or our radiation, or they might develop early coronary artery disease. Two of the presentations at ASH, one by Dr. Angert from Germany and one by Dr. Myers from Canada, showed that there are many circumstances where you can either eliminate the radiation treatment or you can use much smaller fields and dramatically decrease the risks of secondary cancers and also of coronary artery disease. And so we are tailoring and fine-tuning our treatment to produce excellent cure rates while minimizing the toxicity. And I'm going to turn to the last topic I was assigned now, which is quality of life. And as I've just implied, many of our treatments now for lymphomas are focused not just on the effectiveness of getting rid of the lymphoma, but we're also using treatments that are much less toxic than the old-fashioned cytotoxic chemotherapy. With the old-fashioned drugs, we'd infuse them into the bloodstream, and the normal cells and the malignant cells would see the same concentrations of drug, and there would, of course, be lots of side effects. Now we're using a lot of smarter treatments with drugs that are conjugated to antibodies. The antibody binds to the cancer cell and not to normal cells, and you focus and concentrate the drug a lot more on the cancer cell. And so a lot of the antibody drug conjugates have much less toxicity than our conventional agents. We're also using the immune system. I mentioned the bispecific antibody that's very exciting. There also are engineered T lymphocytes, where we take out the patient's own T lymphocytes. We genetically modify the T cells so they work better at killing lymphoma and give them back to the patients. And this is another very elegant approach. And then I mentioned we are learning that we can minimize the radiation in many cases and cut down the risk of toxicities and other problems related to our treatments. So I think I'm going to end there and turn it back over to Dr. Messner.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Press. That was really an outstanding presentation. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, and thank you very much. It's really very comprehensive. Our next speaker is Erin Columbus. Erin is an oncology social worker, and she is the program director of online services of cancer care. And Erin is going to address free psychosocial support services provided by cancer care. I'm now going to turn the program over to Erin.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of this informative call today. As an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, I'd like to talk about the emotional and social impact of cancer and how cancer care can help you. When you're first diagnosed with cancer, it can be an overwhelming experience. You're faced with a series of choices and may not know where to turn for help with those choices. Talking to a cancer care oncology social worker can certainly help you get support that you need. Cancer care is a staff of licensed master's level oncology social workers, and all of our services are completely free of charge. We're experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. And one of the most important things to acknowledge about the emotional impact of cancer is that it can be felt as a loss. It can be a loss that manifests itself in many different ways for both patients and for caregivers. That's why it's so important to have an outlet to acknowledge how you're feeling and to have someone you can talk to who will be supportive and understanding of your experience. This can mean talking one-on-one with a cancer care social worker here or joining one of our online support groups or our telephone or face-to-face groups. So cancer care does offer face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups offer an opportunity to talk with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a cancer care social worker to facilitate the group. Participating in a support group can be helpful simply by allowing you to talk with others who are in a similar situation and who truly understand in a way that no one else can. And group members also offer encouragement and a real sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. Lastly, cancer can certainly have a significant impact on your finances. So for many of the people that I talk to every day, this can be an overwhelming aspect of cancer. Cancer care does provide limited financial assistance for help with transportation to treatment or help with home care, child care, or pain medication. We can also connect you with other organizations for additional assistance to help you with those costs of cancer. Lastly, while we may not be able to resolve all the problems you're facing every day, a cancer care social worker provides a listening ear and the ability to counsel you as you navigate the cancer experience. many people impacted by cancer find this to be a very reassuring and comforting service that can help you to feel less alone. So please contact us if you are interested in any of our services. Our phone number, our HOPE line is 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673. You can also log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you very much for listening.
Well, thank you very much, Erin. That's a wonderful, wonderful presentation about our services at Cancer Care and how people can access them. Very eloquent. Thank you so much. And now we have time for questions. We have a lot of time for questions, and I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board. And I'm going to ask Stephanie also to explain to you how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. So we'll let the questions begin. Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
And we do have a question from someone on the online just now, so here's the question. Are treatments and symptoms for marginal zone lymphoma similar to follicular lymphoma? Explain any differences? Dr. Press, could you address that question?
Yes. Both marginal zone lymphoma and follicular lymphoma are indolent lymphomas, and they are often managed very similarly. Also, small lymphocytic lymphoma, lymphoplasmacytic lymphoma, all the slow-growing indolent or low-grade lymphomas tend to be treated with similar regimens. And as I mentioned before, there are many options. The most popular one now is rituximab with bendamustine, but there are many other acceptable treatments also.
Our next question, Stephanie?
Our next question comes from Mary W. Your line is open.
Thank you for this wonderful presentation. My question is on blood clots. I'm on Revlimid, and I know it has a high incidence of blood clots. Does pomalidomide have a lower incidence of clotting?
That's an excellent question. This is Ken Anderson. Perhaps I should take the first answer on this one. I think that the whole class of drugs that you refer to, thalidomide, lenalidomide, and pomalidomide, all do have by virtue of their similar structure in one family of medicines, do have the same risk. And fortunately, in patients who don't have any other risk factors for clots, just one baby aspirin can, in fact, be, in most cases, sufficient to protect against clots. In patients who are at risk for clots otherwise because they've had one previously or other conditions, then perhaps oral anticoagulation or even subcutaneous injections of something called enoxaparin can be used. But the answer is yes, this whole class of drugs does have a risk, but it can usually and easily be abrogated by just taking a baby aspirin 81 milligrams each day.
Excellent. Thank you. And actually, we have another online question for you, Dr. Anderson, which is, please comment on the role of MRD testing for multiple myeloma patients in remission.
Yeah, that's a very nice and a very prescient question. You know, we didn't need to worry about minimal residual disease in the past because we could never achieve it. But it's a happy new problem. And the way we look for minimal residual disease is two ways that are more sensitive than the typical protein testing or the typical looking under the microscope for visualization and counting of the actual plasma cells. It's simply by what's called polymerase chain reaction or PCR, where we can actually look at the level of the genes that are characteristic of myeloma to see perhaps one in 100,000 or more myeloma cells in 100,000 normal cells. That's the limit of detection. Or the other way that's been used is what's called multi-flow cytometry or multicolor flow cytometry, where we try to find one myeloma cell among many normal cells by virtue of the expression of six different fingerprint proteins on the cell that are not expressed on normal cells. And this has been done primarily by Jesus San Miguel in Spain. But either one of those can find roughly one tumor cell in about 100,000 or so normal cells. And that is now more and more becoming looked at in our clinical trials. I mentioned in my talk, if you combine new drugs like Revlimid, Velcade, and dexamethasone, or other three-drug combinations with novel agents, we're now starting to see significant numbers of patients who are getting molecular complete responses. And ultimately, you heard beautifully from Dr. Shah earlier, chronic myelocytic leukemia, in the 1990s, they were able to achieve molecular complete responses, in other words, no minimal residual disease, with medicines like Gleevec and others. That's where we are now in myeloma. So we're a little bit behind in years, but it is, that is, minimal residual disease negativity will be an endpoint in clinical trials soon.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question for Dr. Shah, actually, from one of our participants about CML and the concept of taking medication or treatment for life, or is there a cure at some point for CML? And Dr. Shah, could you address that?
Sure. As you just heard, CML has been transformed by these targeted therapies, and the majority of patients achieve deep responses, but most patients continue to have some detectable disease using this PCR type testing that you just heard about, but there are people who do test negative who have no minimal residual disease that we can detect. There have been some studies that have looked at stopping treatment in these patients. There was a study in France, and there was good news and not so good news in that. The not so good news was that about 60% of patients had evidence of their disease detectable within 6 to 9 months again by the PCR test when they stopped their imatinib. The other, however, 40% of patients have remained negative for the most part going out to 3 or 4 years. Now, whether or not they're cured in the true sense of the word, meaning that their disease will never come back, it's still too early to know. But it's certainly encouraging that there is a proportion whose disease seems to be continuing to be held at bay. Now, one of the next frontiers in the treatment of chronic myeloid leukemia is how do we get people from a state of having very, very well-controlled disease, but still having some evidence of disease if you look hard enough, and having to continue to take treatment, albeit well-tolerated treatment, but having to continue to take treatment nonetheless. How do we go from that point to where people can stop treatment altogether and never have their disease come back? And there are, in fact, a number of clinical trials that are designed to try to achieve this. It's going to be many, many years before we know the answer to this, just because before any of us are convinced that anybody is cured, we'd probably want at least 10 or 15 years to go by before we would say that someone's disease, you know, is not likely to ever come back. But some of these strategies include inhibitors of a pathway called Sonic Hedgehog. Those of you video gamers out there, I'm sure, are chuckling, but there is a pathway that may be important in the renewal of disease stem cells, of cells that can basically recapitulate the entire disease. That's one avenue of investigation, and there's also one using chloroquine, and well, actually a number of different studies. But as I said, it's very exciting. It's going to be years before you know the answer. But the only way we're going to know the answer, as I tried to mention earlier, is by continued participation of patients with CML in clinical trials.
Excellent. Well, actually, I want to thank all of our speakers today. This has been really a remarkable call, just wonderful speakers. This is really covering all blood cancers and very comprehensive. I want to thank all of you who have queued up and asked questions on either online or actually on the phone. It's terrific to have all of that participation. It helps to really enhance the call. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour education program, and that in planning a program like this, we actually want to remind all of you that there are many services that you can access from Cancer Care after the program ends. So although the program will soon end, that does not mean that the services that you can access from Cancer Care, that those have stopped, that those continue. And indeed, those services, as Aaron had covered, are quite comprehensive, from practical and financial assistance to counseling services, both for the individual counseling and also in groups, both on the telephone and online. You also can listen to our workshops, our telephone workshops, as well as, of course, getting materials and fact sheets and booklets from Cancer Care as well. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone to feel that you're alone. I want you to know that you're part of a community of support and that we're here to help you. If you didn't get to ask your question, please call us, and we're here to help you. If you have other issues or concerns that you have, don't hesitate to call Cancer Care. Our telephone number is 1-800-813-HOPE. And again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect.